September 22nd, autumnal equinox, 2025. We chanted the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta in Pali this evening, and that brings up many, many reflections. But then the overriding reflection is just, for me, it's just in general terms, just coming back to what we have the ability to do as Dhamma practitioners, people who've come in into the orbit of the Buddha's teachings, and that we do have this opportunity to make a commitment. And so I'm very grateful to everybody, both the lay and the monastic community. We've all made this commitment to practice, and then especially those who end up coming to ordain, and whether it's just in Anagarika for 1 year or becoming a novice, and even if you don't go on, that's still an incredible commitment. And then if you become a bhikkhu and you stick with it in this monastery, then that's quite a commitment. And then you get the results of that. Everything we experience in our lives is exactly as it should be. There's nothing wrong. There's nothing out of place. So the Buddha's teachings on kamma is that every single thing we experience is exactly as it should be. It's the causing conditions for that are exactly in place. And whatever we experience, we might feel that it shouldn't be this way, or that it's wrong, that I shouldn't be experiencing what I'm experiencing. This suffering is not right. But whatever we experience in the moment, it is exactly that way, and it should be exactly that way because those causing conditions are there for it. And nothing happens randomly. It's not that we're experiencing what we experience just as some sort of random accident. And if we practice, then the experiences that come from practice don't happen randomly or accidentally. They happen exactly as they should, according to causes and conditions. And if the promise of the Buddha and the Kruba Ajahns and all the great sages of the past, that those who make a commitment and follow the Noble Eightfold Path will experience results exactly in line with what the Buddha taught. Just that if you practice in this way, you will get this result. If you practice in that way, you will get that result. And it happens exactly as it should, according to causes and conditions. So if we feel we're not getting results from the practice, or that we feel maybe it's not working, then maybe to look at various aspects of our practice, are they really truly in line with what the Buddha was teaching? Or is there some way that we're not quite getting it, we're holding it not quite in the right way? Therefore, we are getting results. We're getting results in line with that, but we're not getting the results of peace and clarity and contentment that we desire. And so the results of practice are desirable. It's not that we let go of all desire, but we give rise to a wholesome desire. And there's even this term in the Dhamma called Dhamma Raga. So usually Raga is a very strong term meaning lust. But Dhamma Raga is like a passion for the Dhamma, and it's a necessary quality to develop in terms of a sense of fire for the Dhamma. So the Buddha's not saying just sit back and develop mental blankness. He's saying actually go for it, really develop a sense of fire for cultivating sila, fire for samadhi, fire for panya. So actually developing a really strong intention, a really strong wish, a really strong desire to practice. And those results of clarity and peace and ease and contentment are going to come exactly in line with those causes that we plant. If we really do follow the path, if we really do cultivate right view, if we really do cultivate right intention, if we really do cultivate right speech, if we really do cultivate right action, and so on. We really do cultivate right effort. We really do cultivate right mindfulness. We really do cultivate right steadiness of mind, samadhi. And we can't really separate the path out. It's an integrated approach. It's an integrated path. So the path of practice is not just about, it's not just like doing a meditation retreat and say, I want to do a jhana retreat and get the jhanas together. I need to cultivate the jhanas. And not that that's something, a bad thing, but it's not separate from any other parts of the path. And to think that it's separate is wrong view. So it's not separate. It's not that we take each path factor separately. They're all linked together, and really right view that helps create right intention. Right intention, the intentions of renunciation, intentions of non-ill will, intentions of non-cruelty, those create right speech, which creates right action, and so on. So these all help each other. And then the right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, that feeds back into right view, and it's a circular path. So it's good. It's good to make a commitment. And really, one of the things I keep coming back to that I try to encourage and inspire my own mind is that why I felt connected to the teachings of Lungpur Cha. And when I read Lungpur Cha, I felt that it was actually something very different. It wasn't the path of the world. So a lot of other teachings I was reading, or just things I was involved in, whether it's going to university or just work, you know, working in construction and so on, or any other type of work, making money, that idea of wanting to have a relationship and make a living and maybe raise a family. There was those intentions early on before I came to the monastery, those wishes, those intentions, those dreams. And then when I read Lungpur Cha, oh, this is different. All that other stuff, it's all the same. Whatever work I do, it's all the same. Whatever I choose to do, it's all the same. But this is different. This is something different. Whatever I choose to do in the world, that's all known. That's all something that has been tried. It's been tried by millions and billions of people. It's known. It's known where it leads. It's known what the results are, even the best possible secular life. Okay, well, Lungpur Cha is teaching something different. It's a different path. So, and the Buddha is the ultimate example of this. The Buddha had what we could consider the pinnacle of a really good life of all types of pleasure and all types of fun and enjoyment as a young man. And everything, every type of enjoyment and every type of pleasure imaginable would have been accessible at any time to him. And in the Thai versions of the Buddha's life story, we call Buddha Brawat, there's some quite fun stories in there of his earlier life. And we don't really get that in, say, the sutta-based, just life of the Buddha, the very kind of bare bones, pure kind of life of the Buddha. But some of these commentarial stories, I actually find them very useful for fleshing out or building like a painting, a fuller picture of the Buddha and his, you know, how he was as a young man. So even though he had all this pleasure, it's said that his personality was one of somewhat detached and somewhat aloof already. So that's his parami already showing. And there's a story of the prince Siddhartha. He's like, he's in his 20s or so, and he's already married at that time to Yasodhara. But he's walking down the street in Kapilavatthu, where one of his three palaces, he had three palaces, one for each season. So there's three seasons in Southeast Asia. There's the cold season, the rainy season, and the hot season, and three different palaces, one for each season. And so he's in one of the surroundings of one of the palace areas. And there's kind of one of his relatives and an older woman who's up in one of the kind of towers watching him walk down the street of one of these palace complexes. And she's singing. So it's like kind of like a Disney movie where everybody's singing in the beginning, and they're kind of the characters like walking down the street and people are singing. So it's kind of paints a picture like that. But this person is singing. It's kind of a quiet song, and that the refrain of the song goes, when people see Siddhartha, everybody becomes cool. Everybody he passes becomes cool, and he is cool, and everybody he passes becomes cool. And so it's like a Nibbanati, to become cool. That's like Nibbana. Nibbanati is to become cool. So when everybody sees Siddhartha, and when he passes by people, everybody's Nibbanati. That's like part of the refrain of the song. And it's little like clips like that, I guess you could say ancient clips. They're not YouTube clips. They're ancient, very ancient memories. You have these commentarial stories like this, which are, I find, very, very useful. And so his personality is already, you know, he's also noticing, he's someone who notices that, okay, everything I'm seeing here, there's pleasure all around me, but there's something, there's some sort of intuitive sense that there must be something else other than this. It can't just be, life can't just be this. Just get as much pleasure as you can and then grow old and pass away. And what do you gain from that? So when I read Lungpa Cha, I kind of got that sense of, all right, that's what he's talking about with renunciation. So when the Buddha, we fast forward to the Buddha actually, the prince actually leaving the household life, and that's the beginning of his path really to Buddhahood, is taking that step of leaving home. So that's the commitment. And it comes from that reflection that no matter how much pleasure we get, and no matter how many experiences we have, what lasting benefit does it give us apart from pleasant memories? You know, what lasting benefit does it really give to us? Does it make us more virtuous? Does it make us have a more wholesome mind? Chances are it's just going to increase our attachment more and more. So the more we indulge in sense pleasure, the more the attachment increases. That's not what the heart is usually saying. The heart is saying, well, you know, I need to just get my fill of it and then I can go do that other spiritual stuff. Yeah, I just need to, you know, I need to kind of fill all these pleasures up and then I can go and lead a spiritual life. When I'm old, then I can go and, you know, I need to have fun first. But then it becomes harder and harder to give up. The more we indulge in sense pleasures, the harder it is to give up. Unless we maybe, I mean, maybe not though, maybe if we suffer enough. Maybe if we suffer, maybe if we start to see the suffering of it, but that takes some wisdom, that takes barami to actually see the suffering of it. Sometimes we might need to suffer more. We need to get burned a bit before we want to really practice. So Lungpa Cha is talking about something different. He's talking about looking inward and letting go of the sense desires. So that's incredibly difficult. You know, this on our new calendar, there's this Lungpa Liam quote, this of things that can be relinquished. Nothing is as difficult to relinquish as sensuality. So we're hardwired for this. And this is the roots of existence that we're talking about. We were born because of this. And the mind has these different types of craving and attachment in it, which is the roots of rebirth, and that brought us into this birth. So those roots are very, very strong. So to look into this, the Buddha's talking about insight is really the way through this. And through talk about sila, samadhi, panya, but then getting to that insight, which is seeing the drawback. And the Buddha actually even made these statements like he couldn't reach liberation until he saw the gratification as gratification, the drawback as a drawback, the escape as an escape in the case of the five cords of sense pleasure. So gratification as gratification, it's saying, oh, these things actually are gratifying. They actually do bring some measure of happiness while they're being indulged in. They actually do bring, in that moment, that is happiness. You could say that in the moment that sense pleasure is being indulged in, it is genuine happiness. The mind feels genuinely happy in that moment. But then the danger is it's incredibly fleeting and it's impermanent, doesn't last for long at all, and it's gone. And then there, it's on to the next one. And the escape is the complete abandonment of it. So that's in the wording of the Four Noble Truths, the Nirodha, the ending of suffering, or the non-arising, you could say. The non-arising of suffering is, that's from the complete abandonment. It doesn't really give a technique. It just says the mind completely abandons those cravings. It doesn't say necessarily how to do it. It just says you just do it. So I think that's coming back to the jnanang udapati, panyadupati, aloko udapati, wisdom, knowledge arising, light arising. So it's through the insight that these things are abandoned. So we think of whatever intentions we have around, say, craving and attachment, and we can reflect that that's just more of the same. That's the world. That's just more of the same old stuff. It's been happening for a very long time, time immemorial. But then when we talk about letting go of craving and attachment and abandoning clinging, that's different. That's something different. And the Dhamma, the stream of the Dhamma, is something different. It's something that really sees the drawback of all of that. And see, the problem is, though, where we all get stuck is we only see the gratification and we don't think past that. So I don't care. I don't care. Just give it to me. We don't care if we're going to get hit by a train afterwards. And that's totally natural. But that's why the world is the way it is currently. Just give me pleasure now. I don't care about the results. But then when the wisdom comes up, that really, okay, let's just try to see just past it. What's going to happen? What's going to happen after I indulge in this or that? You know, what is the result going to be? No, I don't care about the results. Just give it to me. The mind has it's almost like a wall or a mental block against seeing. Just look just past it. Just look a little, even try to look a little bit past it. You know, what are the results of these actions going to be? That's what we try to do. That's seeing the drawback and seeing the gratification as gratification, seeing the drawback as a drawback, and seeing the escape as the escape in terms of the five chords of sensual pleasure. And Ajahn Chah was just brilliant in talking about just those basic things that happen when you try to let go of tanha, craving. And it's like Wadpa Pong in the older days, eating one meal a day of like this very Spartan meal. And it's kind of hard to imagine in our time of plenty now where we're so well supported, but say Wadpa Pong in the early days where they didn't actually have much food and it was the one meal a day. And sometimes, especially for the Westerners, really difficult to eat. And you had things like foods that you didn't even know what they were. And these kind of watery, soupy slop that you're eating. And it's one meal. But you're so hungry because it's just, you just get that one meal a day. And Ajahn Chah would say, like, the meal's coming and your mouth is watering and you're so hungry. You just want to eat. That's all you care about in that moment. And just to look at, oh, that's very natural. That's very natural. And we might be hard on ourselves because of those types of cravings arise, but those types of cravings, like when you're very hungry, most of us don't really even know what hunger is. We, even here, we get to eat a breakfast and then the big main meal, and we have tea time in the evening. You know, we might get a little bit hungry in the evening, but we might, unless we've done a fast before, or we've really tried to limit our food, we don't really know what hunger is. So to be really hungry, you know, what is that like? To have real hunger, that's a really good experience. That's a practice experience. When we have hunger and then we look at it and we find the resources to work with it and deal with it without just saying giving into it or just absolutely having to eat something, but just looking at something like hunger. Now, this is this practice when we're able to look at these things. And those of us who come here to live in the monastery at a younger age and the metabolism is more, so the hunger comes up quicker. So Longpo Cha tended to be, it was said that he tended to be very, very metta, very friendly and kind and compassionate toward younger people who came to live in the monastery. And it's said if people came to ordain later in life, he was very fierce with them and very harsh with them. He had to really kind of almost beat them into submission. And because the habits are built up over a lifetime, for the younger people, he could still mold them very, very easily. So sometimes when maybe disagreements arise in the monastery, or sometimes there might be some disharmony, it's a big community, so sometimes there's disagreements between people, and or in the kitchen, have a hard time working with people. Sometimes we might prefer working with this or that person or not want to work with this or that other person. And then we might get irritated and annoyed with people. And we might even give voice to that at times and feel that people shouldn't be this way or that way. And it's at those times that we can reflect that, well, that's the same. That's more of the same. That's the world. That's not what Lumpur Chao is talking about. That's something where it's actually really good. It's really good if we get irritated and annoyed with people. We can really, that's grist for the mill. That's a really great place to practice. It's like when early days in England, when Lumpur Sumedho was starting Chithurst Forest Monastery, and he went back to Thailand to check in with Lumpur Cha, and Lumpur Cha said, "How's it going? How's it going there? How's the monastery going?" And Lumpur Sumedho was kind of waxing lyrically, "Everybody's really sincere, and everybody's getting along with each other, and nobody's irritated with one another, and everything's really, really, everybody's just practicing really hard. Everybody's really sincere. Nobody's missing pujas. Yeah. People are all playing their part." And Ajahn Chah was kind of like, that's not very good. What do you mean? That's going great. It's like, you're not going to get much wisdom there. Nobody's irritated with each other. So it's the path to wisdom is actually when you do have people who rub you the wrong way, or who think of it as like the rock tumbler, where those rough edges get knocked off, then that's where we can give rise to wisdom if we're able to handle it. You know, if we're able to reflect on our own thoughts and our own reactions, if we're able to reflect properly, then yes, it will give rise to wisdom. If we're not able to reflect properly, then we're not going to be able to endure it and we'll end up leaving. Because in a big community, your views and opinions are going to get called into question. Somebody else is going to have a different view and opinion, just as something as simple as that. It's such a strong feeling, that feeling that I'm right is such a strong feeling, you know, but I feel it in my gut. I know I'm right. I know I'm right about this. Like, well, the other person feels the same way and they know they're right and it's a different opinion. So what are you going to do? So to develop a mind like water, where we can actually let go of our views and opinions. And that's a big act of generosity when we don't have to cling to our views and opinions tenaciously anymore, and we're actually able to be open, then some wisdom, we actually let that wisdom in. And then the wisdom, as it's lived, it's dynamic. It's not like we just get the test, we get the multiple choice answer right, and then we have wisdom. It's not that we just figure everything out. But it's dynamic, because it's about how to let go in any situation. It's about skillful response, yoniso manasikara, using our attention wisely and responding wisely to every situation, responding in a way that's going to be in line with Dhamma. Sometimes people might say, just tell me what to do and I'll just do it. But in the Dhamma, there's no just tell me what to do. It's more dynamic than that. There's not like the necessarily an instruction manual that we have. I mean, the suttas and the teachings of the Kripa Ajahns are like a map, and the map is necessary, but the map's not going to tell you all the road closures and where there's a tree down across the road and where you have to divert and maybe go a different direction temporarily. The map is just a basic framework, but then we actually have to driving the path. Now, following the map is a much different experience than just looking at the map. It's a completely different experience. It's what's going to take us to our destination. So the maps, the teachings, these are all necessary and useful to a point. But then to really walk the path, really put the effort in, we're going to find all sorts of things that aren't on the map. There's going to be all sorts of things we're going to experience, all sorts of obstacles we're going to have to overcome. And that's going to be a test of our commitment. So if our commitment is strong and we start to develop in the Sila, Samadhi, and Panya, then we're going to have enough power. We're going to have enough power to our perseverance. We'll develop the power of our perseverance to the point where we will be able to overcome obstacle after obstacle after obstacle. There will be so many obstacles in the path of practice. And it's very, very rare person who doesn't have obstacles. Even the Bodhisattva, before becoming the Buddha, had all sorts of obstacles that he had to overcome, but it was because of the power of his adhitana, determination and perseverance, that he was able to overcome them is because of the power of Lumbar Cha's Aditana and perseverance and the heart of the spiritual warrior, that he was able to overcome all sorts of obstacles. Lumpa Liam, the same, and Lumpa Samedo, all of these teachers, even Lumpa Liam, we see him now, we think, oh, he must not have had any obstacles. But when he talks about his life, he says he had all sorts of obstacles as a young monk, as a junior monk, coming from many different directions. And he was able to overcome them through his purity of heart, purity of intention. So that quality of heart is very important. And Sangha Nusati is also important. We can reflect on great monks like Lumpu Khao, and that great examples like this. So there's a story of Lumpur Cha taking a young Ajahn Sumedho to see Lumpu Khao, and he was on his deathbed, actually. They were going to pay respects and just to be in his presence. And Lumpu Khao, Lumpur Sumedho says that was a very kind of strong moment for him, just seeing how unbelievably radiant and bright and just exuding metta. And even though he was dying and was very, very ill and must have been in a lot of pain, but his eyes were just beaming and he was so happy, unbelievably happy. How could somebody who's in incredible pain and dying be so unbelievably happy? And then that's when they were leaving, and he kind of pulled on Lumpur Sumedho's robe and said, and pointed and just said, "It's all here. It's in the heart. It's all here." And that was Lumpur Sumedho's mentioned that many times. That was a very strong moment for him. That it's all inside. It doesn't come from anywhere else. So that's different. That's not the run of the mill. That's not ordinary. But that's what we're looking for. So, or it's like the story of Tanajan Mun on Tudong and living outside of a village and relying on this village for alms food. And they didn't know about practice monks or about monks in general. They didn't know about what they were doing. So they would spy on him. So Ajahn Mun was doing walking meditation, just walking back and forth in the villagers were spying on him. What in the world is he doing? He's just walking back and forth in the middle of the forest, walking meditation. They didn't know it was walking meditation. They just saw him walking back and forth, and they watched him. And he's many, many hours walking back and forth, and he's had his head down. He's looking. So they thought he was looking for something. They thought he lost something, and they thought he was looking for something. So then somebody popped out of the forest and revealed that they were watching him and said, "Ajahn, what are you looking for? Can we help you find it?" He said, "I'm looking for Bhutto. Whoever finds it is the highest in the world. You can help me find it if you have enough commitment. You can help me find it." So I thought it's kind of a lovely reflection, looking for Bhutto. You know, that's what he's looking for. And whoever finds it is the highest in the world. So I think that's probably appropriate for the amount of time this evening. I think I'll leave it there.